Chuck Coughlin is one of the most astute observers of American politics. This week, we pick his brain on what's currently happening in our politics.
From KTAR News, this is The Think Tank, hosted by Dr. Mike O'Neill.
Okay, Chuck, welcome back to the show.
It's great to see you, Mike.
Well, it's been a while, and there's must be a lot going on in our politics, a lot of it invisible, I think, to the naked eye, particularly in the one thing that the legislature has to deal with, and that is the budget.
Correct.
We need a budget by June 30th.
Correct.
We spoke off mic here a minute ago. Yeah. That's about your estimate about when we're going to get this.
Yeah, I feel pretty confident about that.
Now, there's nothing visible. Now, the only thing I noticed about this, a couple of weeks ago, the governor made a very optimistic statement saying there's some really fruitful negotiations going on in private.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think about that and think, you know, you don't have a deal until you have
a deal.
Until the ink is dry.
Exactly.
You can be 99% there and sit there for a long time. So what's your sense of what happens? The Democrats are two votes shy in each chamber. That's what they need.
Right.
Or one vote and an abstention.
Right.
Well, in each House.
Yep. So the governor is right. There is some productive conversations going on between her and House and Senate leadership, the president and the speaker in particular. And so that has been fruitful. And there is a growing sense of something there that they can work towards. Who's not in the room is, of course, the Democratic minority in both chambers, as you just astutely pointed out, that is one vote short of a majority in both of those chambers. And they need to be part of this because the general thinking down there is that the Freedom Caucus, which consists of maybe 10 members, maybe 11 in the House, fewer in the Senate.
And let's do arithmetic to see how big that is. The House with 10, they've got 32, right?
31. Okay. They got 31 in their majority.
They got 31. So it's about a third of the House. Okay.
So, and you need a majority of the majority to move a bill.
Okay.
And so
you need of the remaining 20, you need most of them.
It gets pretty thin. And so
you're assuming that the Freedom Caucus is no deal.
Yeah. I don't see how they're going to sign on to a budget that the governor's going to support and whatever going home measures are included in that.
There's also implicit in what you just said that the Republicans will stick to the principle of we don't do anything that a majority of our caucus doesn't go for, because the simple arithmetic would say all the Democrats and two Republicans and you got to deal
with.
You say they're not going to do
it. Right. But, well, that was the beginning of the session. They both the House and Senate adopted rules that said a bill could not go to the floor without a majority of the majority. And that meant also including the support of the Speaker and the President. So that's a rule that they've both put in place there.
They not only need a majority, need those two individuals.
Yeah, they've insured themselves.
So basically, they wrote themselves into continuing full power, except that they have to deal with the peskiness of a Democratic governor.
As long as you say, as long as they keep those rules, because, you know, you can change the rules. And so that's the construct they're working under right now.
But to change those rules, you need a majority of the majority, or do you just need a majority
of the
House?
You just need a majority on the floor.
On the floor.
I mean, you just need a majority on the floor. And so, and you need presumably the speaker's position to bring it to the floor, or you got to roll that too. And so that becomes a very big challenge for any Republican wanting to swim against
the tide. Have they ever brought anything to the floor over the objections of the speaker?
Yeah, we did that to Biggs on Medicaid restoration when Jan was governor. Mm-hmm. We rolled him on the Senate floor.
Okay. So it's happened, but it's a nuclear option.
It is a nuclear option. So having said all that, there are good conversations going on. I think what we need to look for is concurrence with the Democrats down there, that they need to be on board. That's going to be difficult because they're not in the room right now. Mm-hmm. So when you bring them in the room, they're not going to be treated like, you know, you can't put baby in the corner. They're going to have their voice heard in the room. And then the additional...
And then if they're not in the discussions right now, you're going to have to assuage some feelings of,
well,
hey...
That, as you just observed, that means changing the deal. Mm-hmm. So we need to change the deal to do this. Does that shake up the other side mm-hmm. of the deck? And then the final thing is, you know, what else is a going home measure? What else do I need to get out of here? Is for instance, is the governor, there's a lot of discussion down there on Prop 400, the extension. We all recall, if people are closely watching this, that's the half cent sales.
Or if you've listened to this show, we had Marty Schulz on a couple of weeks ago.
Right. And that's the half cent sales tax extension, which runs out in 25, that funds all of Maricopa County's transportation. Maricopa County is the only state in the or only county, county in the state that requires the legislative approval of this.
That's
to have an election.
That's backwards, by the
way. It's totally backwards.
And if in many things in many states, you have power invested in the large counties, and you have restrictions on what the tiny counties can do.
So the question there is, does that get revisited as a way to get out of there? Because if you can't, back to the Freedom Caucus, most of the Republican objections to that plan to date have been the degree to which it funds transit. The current plan that the mayors all agreed to had about 41% on transit, about 14% of that on light rail. And the legislature is saying zero on light rail and maybe some percentage on transit. If you're Phoenix, if you're Tempe or Mesa and you want transit because you really don't need more freeways, your freeways are built out, you're an interior community, you need transit dollars. And so do you even participate? Do you say, I'm in or no, I'm out?
If you lose Phoenix, Tempe, Mesa, you don't
pretty
have
much lose the election.
You pretty much lose.
You pretty much lose the
election. Now, the interesting thing about that now, the road part of this, the freeway part of this, is pretty much runs through Republican areas.
Yeah, that I mean, it's an amazing thing because how important freeway construction is to the West Valley. Mm. You know, anybody in the I-10 commute from the West Valley knows what a disaster it is. One of the big things here is the I-10 reliever, which is due to run about a mile south of I-10 all the way out to Buckeye. That would be funded under the Prop 400 extension. And without that, that's not happening. So you're just bumper to bumper, and it's only going to get worse. You have freeway improvements on the 303 corridor out there and on the 202 corridor out there. And you have a bunch of arterial developments in South Phoenix that are important to the Rio Salado area down there as well. So there's a bunch of stuff that's counterweighted for those communities. And the other thing on the transit side, which is ironic to the end of time, most of the Valley's retirement communities, Sun City West, you know, Apache Junction, parts of that East Valley, need transit now. They're getting older. They want transit. They want bus service. And that is part of the transit equation. And, you know, a lot of Republicans are like, but when they start hearing from their constituents.
And they don't think they're constituents.
They are, though. I mean, that's the crazy thing. And so there's a lot of movement going on down there, including this discussion of, why are we even voting on this? Why don't we just let Maricopa County just decide this? If you're a conservative Republican, why the heck are you even voting on this? Just give it to the county. Let the county deal with it. If you're a rural legislator, why am I even voting on this?
So, well, isn't that the way Republicans have traditionally constrained spending in Arizona? They set up multiple obstacles. You need an obstacle that you have to pass. Some legislative body has to permit it to go on the ballot. Then you also have to win
a
ballot election, as opposed to elected legislators simply voting to tax those things
that's exactly the way to get it done. And we have a history of that in Maricopa County. 1986, we passed Prop 300. 2004, we passed Prop 400. This would be an extension of that to fund our Valley
No new taxes, merely the extension of existing taxes.
Which is,
now, in a rational world, I'd look at that and say, okay, the West Valley and some outskirts area would like some freeways. The interior, Mesa Tempe, wants some transit. We do something that's a mixture of both.
And that was the mayor's plan. They all unanimous. It was a long-term thing, and all the mayors got together, endorsed a plan, which would do exactly that. And it was fund all of their
And the mayors aren't all Democrats.
No. Many of them, most of those West Valley mayors are certainly Republicans. Right. Back to getting out of there, getting out of the legislature becomes this equation of, you know, who wants what to get out of there beyond the budget? Because once you relieve the trigger on the budget, everybody leaves and you can't get anything else done.
Well, you mentioned one other thing that may have to be part of the deal as far as the governor's concern about the budget. And that's water.
Right. We saw that about a week ago. We saw Chris Mayes, our attorney general, start to raise some issues about the regulatory lack of regulation in greater Arizona. So 80% of the state has no groundwater regulation as a landmass outside of the AMAs, the five counties that have regulated water. You can just drop a well anywhere and go drop it as far as you want and pump as many gallons as you want. And your neighbor is SOL. And you can just pump till your heart's content. And that is a problem. So the question becomes, how do you create aquifer health in greater Arizona? The as you recall, during the governor's State of the State speech, she spoke about this at length. The attorney general's raised issues about this. The obstruction to it is the farming and ranching interests down at the Arizona legislature, who highly value the free market and their individual.
Because right now they're unrestrained.
Right. Let's say you're a big farmer, own a ton of land, or you're a big rancher and own a ton of land. The value of you being able to determine your own economic future on water is valuable.
You're a big farmer. You can afford to dig a deep well and you're
on
okay.
On any part of your property, which then you could develop.
In other words, you could have some little corner of your property hooks in to an aquifer, most of which is under somebody else's property, but you're pulling it out.
You're pulling it out.
Off of your property,
right.
That's actually
what happened down in Cochise County. This large dairy from Minnesota came in and purchased a ton of land and started dropping wells. They have tons of cattle down there, dairy cattle down there right now. And there's aquifer challenges throughout the aquifer. The DWR, the Department of Water Resources, already said that aquifer is not in good shape. It's going to go dry unless we do something.
And that is currently unregulated. That's one of
Yeah, absolutely, because it's outside.
The other thing I understand from talking, having had water people in on this show, is that the complication is that Arizona is not a single water system. There's six or seven completely different systems. And right now, you say, for example, we've gotten a lot of rain, and much of the state is pretty good shape for this year, but the Colorado River is dry as ever.
Yes. You know, if you're in the SRP watershed, You just say your prayers every day, and God has been good to you.
That doesn't mean you're okay for the long run, but this year's not a problem.
Probably 3 years with their water system, they're pretty good to go. But if you're on the other side of the valley and relying on Colorado River water, you're in a jeopardy situation. I mean, the Department of Bureau of Land Management or Department of the Interior just announced, you know, a proposed cross the board 13% cut for all users of that. I mean, or if that doesn't go through, there's an option that CAP essentially gets zeroed out. You get no water if they go by the current agreements with California and the other states. Arizona would get zeroed out.
And I think that was the original sort of agreement with California to get the thing built.
Exactly.
Left us high and dry under certain circumstances.
Yeah, which back in the day, and when Governor Babbitt was governor, that's what created these active management areas. So there's five active management areas in the state that cover all of the users of that Colorado River water, because they were saying, hey, we want you people to be responsible about the water you're using. And so Yavapai, Maricopa, Pinal, Pima, and a county down on the border.
Santa Cruz?
Yeah, Santa Cruz, all required active management areas. None of the rest of the state has any management areas. So, you know, that was always one of Governor Babbitt's things. How do I finish, you know, how do we finish creating a of rigorous management goals and plans for Arizona.
Like most people in the urban areas, at least, when confronted with that, and said, well, should we manage our water? We say, well, duh. You mean we're not right now?
Yeah. Our data shows it's immensely popular. Not a heavy regimen. We're not talking about heavy regulation, but maybe on an individual aquifer that's not in health, create a plan to restore that aquifer's health. And provide some money to that to restore the aquifer's health. So, I mean, there's all kinds of things that may delay getting them out of there, depending on how many issues does the governor say, I'm not going home until I get these things resolved.
And you suggested earlier that she pretty much has to do that because once the budget is passed, she has no leverage.
Right.
She has no leverage.
Right.
The Democrats want to do something here. Most the general weight of the Republican Party is do nothing.
Well, the Republicans tried to do that earlier this year. They passed the skinny, quote-unquote, skinny budget, sent that up to her, and she promptly vetoed it, knowing that her leverage on the entire session comes down to signing that budget. Mm-hmm. I want everybody to get what they want. And have a representative budget of what if she had signed that budget at any point in time. Because as we started the segment, that's the only real responsibility that the government has is adopt a budget.
They knew that wouldn't be signed.
No, right.
That was sort of like her state of the state address, which is this is what I want.
Right.
This is the Republicans' counter, which said this is what we want.
Right. And so
and nothing's going to happen unless they both say yes.
And they both have to sit down. And talk, and they have to be in the room together, and the Democrats have to be in the room, and everybody has to play nice with one another.
Okay, we have in the last several weeks here expelled a newly elected Republican a Republican legislator was expelled by a Republican House.
Yeah.
What's the story?
Well, Liz Harris, the aforementioned representative from Chandler, began her career going down to the legislature saying she's not going to vote for anything until we fix our election systems and we uncover the fraud that that she says existed in the system, and literally went about not voting for anything, including the aforementioned skinny budget. She would refuse to vote for that, which was the speaker's principal goal at that point in time. So she voted against that the first time around, made the speaker very, very unhappy. Then he had to concede to letting her have a legislative hearing on these election measures, which then he does. And that becomes the time in which she makes these outrageous, phony allegations.
She brought in somebody who made them, but she knew what she was going to say.
She knew exactly what she was doing and brings that in and embarrasses the entire body. Well, guess what? Don't piss off the speaker. So the speaker saw that as you just gave me the rope to hang you with. He introduces a resolution to ban her. That was his resolution. And Republicans said, you're gone. And now we are in a process of appointing a new member, which the statute says that is the responsibility of the aforementioned precinct committeeman from that district. That
was pulled from her segment of the party. They renominated her and two folks who looked an awful lot like her.
Yes.
It goes to the County Board of Supervisors, which is controlled by the other wing of the Republican Party.
Yes, which are not election deniers. Yeah. And so it used to be, so this is an interesting sort of historical fact, that the County Board of Supervisors would just put together a committee. And the committee would nominate from the community a group of people who were part of the that could be nominated. Now, Mr. Kanasik, I think, did a regretful thing in his opinion, requested a change in the statute to empower the precinct committeeman to make the decisions. They've now done that. There's no timeline on this, though. So the county board can sit on it forever, which is a huge problem for the legislature.
And which they can do.
Yes.
I had speculated before, and the unknown legal thing is, can they reject them all and say, send us more names?
Yes.
That's unclear, but they can really have it better just by they've got the power to do nothing.
Right.
And at some point, the House Speaker comes, or the Republicans in the House say, that's a Republican seat.
Yeah.
And we want it filled.
And they're one seat short.
Right. And prior to it would take two Republicans to flip.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden it's one.
Well,
with that seat vacant,
you ask, why has the legislature been on spring break the last 2 weeks?
Because
they don't have the votes to pass anything.
Yeah.
And so they need another member down there. Mm-hmm. And so my understanding is that this seat is from Jack Sellers' district. That's an East Valley legislative or supervisory district. He's interviewing, I think, early next week, the three members they've sent to him, one of whom was Julie Willoughby, who just missed beating Liz Harris by, you know, a couple hundred votes or something
close,
like that.
Yeah.
It was a very close election. You know, so likely, you know, I think they'll probably end up sending her down there, or her with some requests, maybe to change the statute to open up the nominating process and maybe put a timeline on it. And so create some compromise and create maybe a bigger pool of future legislators that they could choose from.
But that changing the rule would be for next time, no? Or would be
correct.
For this time?
Correct.
For next time.
It would be
for
next time.
We've obviously seen the problems with the existing set of rules.
Yes.
The ambiguity about the county's ability to reject.
Yes. And the fact that this pool is, I mean, they sent Liz Harris back to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not going to fly. They're not going to reappoint Liz Harris.
Well,
they're going to interview her.
That's the in your face aspect of it.
That's what precinct committeemen do. Right?
Well, these are the folks who censured John McCain and another. This is that group.
Well,
that's
who the not precinct only John McCain. They
long list.
Censured a long list of Republicans. Mm-hmm. Probably Jan Brewer and Ben Thoma himself. And you know, they've had their hooks out for a lot of folks. So these are the most strident populist Republicans in the state.
We got just a minute or two. We might as well talk tamales here.
Okay.
The only bill I think that got vetoed that wasn't a pure Republican bill.
Yeah.
This was a joint bill, and
home cooked food
do you need to be regulated, basically.
So I call this the Jake Hoffman revenge, because remember this, they've got a committee down there that vets all of the governor's appointments. The governor had a Department of Health secretary that she appointed. They tubed her. They ended up going shelving that. There's no director now at the department. This is obviously a health department issue. When the bill first came up, they were registered, the DHS, the governor's people were registered as neutral. Mm-hmm. Well, that changed to opposition. That's probably not a good look. You want
to make your call up front.
Yeah, just make the call up front. Or if you need changes in the statute, articulate what those are and try and accomplish those before it goes up to the boss.
I'm guessing that this is a little egg on the face for the governor, but it's fixable. They put together something that they have enough smokescreen change in there that they pass something and she signs it.
Yeah. I mean, they could maybe do that. Again, is this part of the budget? Is this part of going home? Is this something that people care enough about? Or is this something we can do next year and come back and do that? So, you know, yes, I imagine we'll be eating homemade tamales at, you know, the park and swap.
As we have.
You know, the park and swap. As we've been doing a long time, and there'll be other food products out there soon that folks can sell and make a profit, and we'll all enjoy those.
Thanks very much, Chuck Coughlin. Always fun to talk to you.
Pleasure being here, Mike. Thank you for the opportunity.